The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of
auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you
to discover the difference at
necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system,
improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at
imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. New Englanders tend to break down into two camps: the outdoor enthusiasts who long for winter's white slopes, and those of us who grumble about the dark and cold, turn up the heat, read, and watch Netflix. If you count yourself among the latter, it may be time to take a page from the people of Norway, who, according to new research, don't seem to suffer from the same sorts of seasonal mood swings as we do here in America's Northeast. Laura Vanderkam is an author and contributor to Fast Company, where she recently shared some Norwegian secrets to embracing winter.
So tell us a little bit about this. Carrie Leibowitz, now she's a PhD student who did this study. What was she looking at and why?
Well, she had spent a year in northern Norway, and originally she went to study why rates of seasonal blues seem to be a little lower than you would expect, given that in the north of Norway, the sun doesn't rise from late November to late January. They're so far north. And so she went to study that, and she was asking people, well, why aren't you depressed in the winter? And their answer was, why would we be? And she thought that was very fascinating. And so her research studied on this, the wintertime mindset that makes it possible to enjoy rather than endure winter.
A mindset? What are Norwegians doing that we in New England aren't?
Well, we might be doing some of these things, but there is a word that's, I'm going to pronounce it wrong because my Norwegian is shockingly not that great, but it's like kuselig, and it means coziness. And the way to think of it is Christmas without all the stress, right? It's like the best parts of Christmas, the candles, the coziness, the friends, the warm drinks and get-togethers and things like that. And they view winter as a great time for that. So there's lots of fires and fireplaces, even in sort of public buildings. They also have a saying that there's no bad weather, only bad clothing. And so if you are miserable, maybe that's a sign that you need something a little bit warmer, something a little bit more wind or waterproof, and that if you are able to deal with the harsh parts of the elements, then you can get outside and enjoy the beautiful parts of it, because there are beautiful parts of winter if we're willing to open our eyes and look.
Well, that sounds wonderful and cozy, but I'm wondering if there's any, I don't know, besides getting together with people, you said it was about an attitude. Is there any direct advice on how not to handle the coming winter?
Well, you can choose whether or not to be in a negative frame of mind about winter. The way I put it is refuse to participate in the misery Olympics. I think a lot of us have a tendency to start our wintertime conversations by complaining about the weather. Oh, it was a horrible commute. Oh, it was so cold. Like, oh, this weather is so terrible. Can't wait for spring. And when we start our conversations that way, that sets the tone. But when you dwell on unhappiness, you get more of it. So better off to start with something good about the winter, because there's always good, no matter where you look, whether it's that the snow is beautiful this morning, or, you know, we had great hot chocolate last night, or whatever it is. Dwelling on something that is good puts you in a good frame of mind for enjoying rather than enduring winter.
I admire that, but I'm just wondering if, you know, people who do suffer from sad seasonal affective disorder are just going to feel even worse about themselves, thinking that, oh, well, if I just improve my attitude.
Well, I think there's a dividing line here, because there are people who truly do clinically suffer from seasonal affective disorder, and that's a different matter. For those people, you need to get what help you need to get, and whether that's light boxes, treatment, mental health professionals. That's great. I think most of us do not fall into that camp. We are perhaps unhappy in winter, but not in a sort of clinical sense of depressed about it. And for people who fall in that more sort of middle of the road category, you can consciously choose to make the most of it and to get outside, even if the weather is not great, and to enjoy that fresh air and to get together with friends and to enjoy breaking out the sweaters and the scarves and the boots and things like that.
Are you going to do that this winter?
I am going to try my best because I am not much of a winter person myself, but I'm planning on asking for some better cold weather running gear for Christmas so I can break away from the treadmill and enjoy running outside.
Well, Laura, thank you so much and have a wonderful winter.
You too.
Laura Vanderkamp, she's author of several books, including I Know How She Does It, How Successful Women Make the Most of Their Time. You can find a link to read her article on the Norwegian winter mindset, which she wrote for Fast Company. It's at wordofmouthradio.org.
A few days ago, we at Word of Mouth all gathered together for a big conversation about holiday traditions. And this is just going to make a whole lot more sense if I just play the tape and let Virginia take over from here.
The holidays are a time for good tidings and cheer and tradition, presumably, because let's face it, not everyone has a family holiday tradition. And for some, new life circumstances, maybe the birth of a child or the death of a loved one, can render those beloved old customs obsolete. So if you're among those looking for something new to do this year, look no further. The Word of Mouth crew is here to help offer up their tried and true holiday traditions. We've got everybody around the table today. So, Taylor, let's begin with you. Someone's shopping for a new routine. This is Word of Mouth senior producer Taylor Quimby. What are you looking for?
I don't know. I think I'm just looking for something sort of unusual, something that seems unique, but obviously I want to steal it from someone else. So it won't be entirely unique. But, you know, something that my kid, my son Phineas, will remember when he grows up as being just this thing that we did every year and he was really excited about. I kind of have, you know, some vague traditions. Like we would open one present on Christmas Eve and our stockings would get, you know, mysteriously put in our room. And so those are traditions that I remember. But I don't know. I feel like I hear sometimes people talking about these really creative things that their family did when they were growing up, and they sound awesome. I want one of those.
Okay. Does anyone have really creative things that your family did when you were growing up?
Well, we have a, this is Logan. We have a take on your stocking idea, which you could try out.
Okay.
So our family, I was one of four children, and I was the most hyperactive and definitely the one that was totally jazzed about Christmas. But all of us went through that. All of my siblings went through that at some point. So what my dad came up with was every morning we would wake up to find one single present. And so then we would all kind of crowd in the same room because that was kind of the deal. But we would open up one little present. It would be a toy, like a Slinky or some little thing to play with. And that's what would keep us in our room if we woke up early.
Oh, wait. Every morning?
I'm sorry. Christmas morning.
On Christmas morning. Just
every morning of our lives.
Well, I was thinking, that's a lot of presents.
My dad gave us a lot of presents. No, but so sometimes it would be like a little stuffed animal or it would be like a little toy. And it was always the most exciting part for me as a kid was to wake up and have this magical, like, one single present to open, like, on the sly.
Hmm. Such a good strategy, too, because keeping children in the bedroom. Like, our stockings were all in a very sort of public place. They were all hung together with care, by the way.
As they should be.
Molly?
Well, so we do this thing every year. It's not really something we came up with. I think it's supposed to be German. You hide a pickle on the Christmas tree or a pickle ornament.
A pickle?
I've seen the pickle ornament and always wondered why.
Oh, yeah. So you have a pickle ornament and somebody is supposed to be the finder every year. You're supposed to rotate. But if you're an only child like I am, you end up being the one who finds it most years. And you hide it as you are decorating a Christmas tree. With the strict rule that whoever is supposed to find it cannot look for it preemptively. And then on Christmas morning, before you open anything, somebody has to find the pickle ornament, or that one person has to find the pickle ornament.
But do you like, I mean, is that something you recommend? Like,
it is.
Like Taylor pick up for his family?
Yeah. I mean, you get a little resentful if it takes too long, but.
Right, because everyone's waiting to open their presents.
Yeah. You're really on the spot.
What about you, Megan?
So my family, my mom and I were generally the ones who were pulling Christmas along. Like, my dad didn't really like Christmas. And my sister was like, meh. So we used to, like, actually in my family, like, every single year my parents used to have, like, this Christmas tree fight where it was, like, they didn't know, like, how big they wanted the Christmas tree. It became kind of like a, oh, well, this is what happens every year. And also there was, like, all of this anxiety with, like, what to get people for Christmas. And because my dad was like, ugh, I don't care. And my sister was like, meh. My mom and I were like, well, why don't we just do away with the presents altogether, you know? And instead of getting gifts for people, we decided, why don't we just take all that money and go on a trip instead? So instead of things, which everybody has, and if they want, they can just buy them on their own, we can share experiences.
So did you ever feel like the outsider at school? I mean, 16 is kind of old enough to make your decisions about this kind of thing.
Well, now I can definitely tell you that I'm awful at buying gifts because I don't have the practice of, like, making lots of lists for people and, like, really thinking about what it is that they want, which has shifted me into a new, like, tradition, and that's, like, gag gifts.
You know, Megan, your story totally reminded me of a tradition that is a really weird one in our family. And I realize I don't think I know anyone else who has this, but no one in our family ever wanted to pack up the ornaments and all the decorations after Christmas. Like, nobody wanted to do that. So we came up with this solution where they were always packed in those banker boxes, you know, those, like, white boxes with the little twine on the sides.
Sure.
Whoever was in charge, whoever was assigned the job of packing it up, would write a note and recap Christmas on the box. So they'd say, this Christmas, like, I remember this one really well, writing, you know, this Christmas was the year of the Apple because we got an Apple II Plus computer when I was a kid. And I said, and it was great because Dad wasn't yelling as much. Like, there are all these, like, little snapshot moments of our family where, so then the next year when you go to put the ornaments out, you read what happened in the previous year. And my parents still have these boxes, and they're like, there's just years and years of documentation. And it was sort of the stress of the season. It was like taking advantage of the fact that people were always crabby about it because, the you know, it would always start.
And then
with,
did,
like,
you suddenly want to do it because you wanted to be the recapper?
Yeah. Because then you could write whatever you wanted. That was the rule, is you could write whatever you wanted. It would often be like, I got stuck putting the ornaments away again. You know, like, so it's kind of a fun little tradition.
Well, that's very nice, because I think the point of a tradition is to sort of, like, thread a string from last year to, you know, to this year, and sort of make that connection and remember something that you used to do.
Yeah.
Virginia, you have a big family.
I have
a huge family.
We did, but I actually have to say I may be a little bit of a bummer in this circle because my dad died last year before Christmas, and my mom has Alzheimer's, and so they were the sort of emotional glue for why everyone gathered at Christmas, and also the planner. You know, my mom was sort of the planner and put all the food together and the presents and that kind of thing. So it feels sad. It feels like we've dissolved. Our Christmas traditions have kind of dissolved. But one of the most, we're a family of 11 children, so let's just assume we're Catholic. And my aunt had brought back from Rome a little baby Jesus made of wax that had human hair. And we were so fascinated by this thing. And it would only appear on Christmas night or Christmas Eve. So, you know, it would be there in the morning when we got up. But during Advent, if we were good, we'd go out and get this, what we called love grass, this really super, super soft field grass. And if we were good, we'd get to put one piece of love grass in the manger for the little baby Jesus to miraculously appear. I don't know how. Wow. I guess he worked in with Santa. Yeah. It was bizarre. But
I like the human hair.
With the human hair, we just couldn't wait for it to arrive because it was wearing this little, you know, swaddling clothes and human hair. It was so weird. So I don't know if I'm recommending that, but here's one crazy thing we do. We sang. We always would sit around. My sister played piano when we were growing up in the house. Not my parents' house didn't have that that they retired to, but I've got brothers who play guitar. So we love to sit around and sing Christmas carols, and I miss that so much. I really have been sort of like, you know, looking for an itinerant bunch of carolers that I can just join up with.
Maybe you should start one. Like, maybe you should start a group. Maybe you should go out and start singing.
We've got some decent voices here.
Yeah.
He's just looking
we'll
around.
Be your backup crew. I'll do some backup dancing.
I'm borderline tone deaf, but I will help you. I would sing with you.
Really?
I think when you get to the point in your life, like, I don't have children, so I'm not really in a situation where I need to, like, you know, spread the magic of Christmas to my kids. But my husband and I always try to do on Christmas what we both really want to do. And sometimes for us, it's like the dumbest things. Like one year, he just played Legos all morning. And he's a grown man. But we just, I think for us, the tradition is that we wake up in the morning and we really sort of appreciate, we both do what we would want to do on Christmas. And I think you have to sort of capture the essence of whatever it is that Christmas means for you and then keep it alive for yourself. Whatever works for you, I think, is usually really the best tradition.
I think that's the best place to end this conversation.
Silent night, holy night.
Virginia Prescott, Logan Shannon, Megan Tan, Molly Donahue, and myself all talking about holiday traditions there. I am still in the running for some wacky, unique, or maybe charming holiday traditions that I can borrow. So if you've got a great annual custom that you do every December, share it with us on our Facebook page and I'll take a look. Facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And thanks. Have you ever wondered how that Christmas tradition of having NORAD track Santa Claus began? Well, in this episode of StoryCorps, the children of Air Force Colonel Harry Shoup share the story of how their very serious father inadvertently started tracking Santa's sleigh way back in 1955.
I remember two phones on his desk. One was this red phone. Only a 4-star general at the Pentagon and my dad had the number.
This was the 50s. This was the Cold War, and he would have been the first one to know if there was an attack on the United States.
So first couple weeks of December in 1955, Dad was at the office, and the red phone rang. He answered it. This is Colonel Shoup. And then there was a small voice that just asked, is this Santa Claus?
Dad was very straight-laced, very disciplined.
He was annoyed.
He was upset.
He thought it was a joke.
Yeah, and so now the little voice is crying.
And Dad realized that it wasn't a joke. So he talked to him, ho-ho-ho'd, and asked if he had been a good boy, and may I talk to your mother? And the mother got on and said, you haven't seen the paper yet? There's a phone number to call Santa. It's in the Sears ad. Dad looked it up, and there it was, his red phone number. And they had children calling one after another. So he put a couple airmen on the phones to act like Santa Claus.
It got to be a big joke at the command center. You know, the old man's really flipped his lid this time. We're answering Santa calls.
The airmen had this big glass board with the United States on it and Canada, and when airplanes would come in, they would track them.
And Christmas Eve of 1955, when Dad walked in, there was a drawing of a sleigh with 8 reindeer coming over the North Pole.
Dad said, what is that? They said, Colonel, we're sorry. We were just making a joke. Do you want us to take that down? Dad looked at it for a while, and next thing you know, Dad had called the radio station and had said, this is the commander at the Combat Alert Center, and we have an unidentified flying object. Why, it looks like a sleigh. Well, the radio stations would call him like every hour and say, where's Santa now? And later in life, he got letters from all over the world, people saying, thank you, Colonel, for having, you know, this sense of humor. And in his 90s, he would carry those letters around with him in a briefcase that had a lock on it, like it was top secret information. You know, he was an important guy, but this is the thing he's known for.
It was probably the thing he was proudest of.
Oh, I'm sure it was, yeah.
That was Terry Van Curen, Rick Shoup, and Pam Farrell remembering their dad, Colonel Harry Shoup, at StoryCorps in Castle Rock, Colorado. Their conversation will be archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. It's late December, a time of celebration and togetherness when we revel in nostalgia, which, as is often acknowledged, can make this a very difficult time of year for those unfortunate individuals who don't like Star Wars. What with all the box office records, product tie-ins, and unavoidable enthusiasm for the franchise, Star Wars haters are up against the ropes this week. One of them is Brett Burke, author of The Gay Uncle's Guide to Parenting. Brett recently wrote an essay for The Drive called Why I Hate Star Wars, which is now the focus of a barrage of nasty comments for even printing Brett's post. Virginia spoke to Brett last week and asked how he was handling the hate mail.
Well, you know, I write a lot of things that end up on the internet, and you know, one of the core lessons of writing for the internet is don't read the comments.
Yeah, but now you're messing with Star Wars. Isn't this a whole nother realm?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't gotten any hate mail or death threats or anything like that at my actual home, so I'm feeling pretty secure. Although, you know, there was a guy in a Chewbacca suit standing on my porch when I got home the other day.
Well, is it really Star Wars that you can't stand, or is it the cultural obsession with the movies that bothers you?
Strangely enough, it's both. I mean, I find I found the movies themselves to be kind of tedious, and I feel like there's also this cultural angle that I find troubling. That's this sort of infantilization that goes on around the movies, where you know, generationally, these were touchstone movies for people my age. I'm in my 40s. Saw the first movie in the theater, and I understand the idea that they take us back, but I think that the literality of the way in which they take us back, with grown people, you know, wearing Star Wars onesies and eating Star Wars cupcakes, you know, there's something troubling about that to me.
Do you think Star Wars was the real turning point for that, this infantilization or, you know, acting like children?
Well, I think, you know, it came about during a time when America was sort of in decline, right? The malaise years of the mid-1970s, you know, stagflation and the demoralization of our military in Vietnam and all of those kinds of things, the aftermath of that. And I think, you know, people were looking for a way to be told that everything's going to be okay. And these kinds of simple-minded stories with dichotomous good guy, bad guy relationships somehow make people feel better about that situation.
So is there nothing redeeming about that, about the franchise in your eyes?
Well, I don't want to say nothing redeeming. I mean, you know, some of the costumes were kind of funny.
How about the whole thing about, you know, the hero's journey, the ancient myth of the fatherless searching for, you know, the Joseph Campbell approach?
Sure. I mean, yes. You know, if you want to get behind sort of a fatuous foundational family drama, yes. It's right there for you.
How do you really feel, Brett? So I take it you're not going to be going to see the new movie.
I have not seen the new movie. You know, who's to say, right? We all participate oftentimes in things we hate. You know, I have to go to Christmas with my partner's family, you know, every other year. These, you know, there's things like this that we attend just because they're a part of what you're supposed to do. But this, you know, this one is certainly a choice. But you can never tell. Anyone can get swept up.
Right. So I'm hearing a little bit of never say never then.
Well, I don't like to be quite as dichotomous in my approach as the Star Wars film.
There's some gray area for Brett Burke. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
And good luck with all the hate mail you're going to be getting after this interview.
I look forward to it.
Brett Burke, he's a contributor to Vanity Fair and author of The Gay Uncle's Guide to Parenting. You'll find a link to read his article, Why I Hate Star Wars, at wordofmouthradio.org. And just a reminder, the views expressed in this program are not those of New Hampshire Public Radio, its staff, or its underwriters.
Earlier this week, I totally geeked out when I found out that SpaceX, Elon Musk's private space venture, successfully landed stage one of their Falcon rocket on Cape Canaveral, less than an hour after launching it and 11 satellites into space. My dad loves to talk about how he watched the moon landing live on television. And while, no, I did not catch the SpaceX web stream as it happened, the enthusiasm was just as infectious when I watched it online the next morning.
LZ-1, the Falcon has landed. Landing operators moving to procedure 11.100, section 3 on LZ-1, VNet, recovery.
Now, if you haven't been following SpaceX and their mission to create a reusable rocket, this is truly an incredible moment in space travel, because rockets, they are really expensive. In March, Musk pointed out during an interview with Bloomberg Business that replacing a rocket that's been ditched after use costs $60 million. Refueling a reusable rocket costs maybe $300,000. So if this achievement can be perfected and repeated, going to space just got a hell of a lot cheaper. Granted, it may not have been as sexy as stepping foot on the moon, but I will always remember what I was doing when I watched a GIF of the Falcon coming back to Earth. I was lying in bed, staring at my smartphone, laughing out loud with excitement. Now, just about a year ago, I was substitute hosting Word of Mouth, talking about how the private space industry was in trouble. At that time, SpaceX and Virgin Galactic had both suffered big setbacks, and the media was questioning whether we can truly overcome the technical barriers that stand in the way of cheap commercial spaceflight. Well, now we have a little momentum in that direction, but what about the psychological and physical barriers? Sydney Brownstone is a staff writer for the Seattle newspaper The Stranger. She's also a contributor to Fast Company, where she wrote about the often ignored mental side of space travel. I spoke to her last year. So, Sydney, it's worth pointing out that you're not really writing about the mental pressures on people who would, say, travel to Mars and maybe be on a spaceship for years at a time. You're looking at the side effects experienced by pilots who are flying suborbitally. That's at very high altitude. So tell us a little bit about the phenomenon that you describe, this break-off phenomenon.
Right. Well, I think it'll be helpful to contextualize the break-off phenomenon in another type of syndrome I stumbled across called the overview effect. This is a syndrome or an experience that, the CEO of Virgin Galactic, George Whitesides, is invested in. There's something called the Overview Institute. Basically, it's this idea that when you pay for space travel, anyone can go up and have this really beautiful epiphany about the fragility of the Earth and the unity of humankind. And it's supposed to be incredibly emotional and intense.
Positive way.
In a very positive way. This is one of the selling points. Some space tourism companies actually use it in their marketing materials. So I knew about this overview effect, and when I started interrogating it a little bit and going through the medical literature, I came across another kind of parallel syndrome called the break-off phenomenon. And this is something that was first reported in 1957 in a paper that interviewed 137 fighter pilots. And this is a term they came up with themselves, the break-off phenomenon. It was this feeling of when they would get up to high altitudes, of feeling dissociated or separated from the Earth. And dissociation is not a term to be taken lightly. It's a very, very, it can be a very scary feeling.
This is sort of what the out-of-body experience.
Right. And the weird thing about the break-off phenomenon, too, is that it wasn't always positive and it wasn't always negative. So two-thirds of the pilots who did describe break-off described it as something calm and peaceful. A few felt closer to God. And then there were about a third of the pilots said they freaked out, basically.
Yeah. Well, how does the break-off effect manifest physically? I mean, we're talking psychologically about people, feeling very calm or feeling closer to God. But what is happening to their bodies?
It's hard to say. A lot of people report a variety of effects. In the medical literature, I found one case of a squadron commander who was hyperventilating and basically displaying the symptoms of a panic attack or several panic attacks. He would get this tightness in his chest. He would lash out at his coworkers. And those kind of all seemed like symptoms he developed after experiencing the break-off phenomenon. But I think that the main symptom is this feeling of dissociation. You feel separated from the Earth, which if you think about it, can be a really positive thing. Oh, I feel free. I feel surreal. And then it can also feel extremely unsettling.
And what happens when this occurs? I mean, they're experiencing something, but how does that affect their ability to fly?
There have been a lot of different conclusions. When we first started flying astronauts and cosmonauts, NASA and the Russian Academy of Sciences, they were very concerned about break-off happening to astronauts and ruining missions. But some researchers concluded that it just wasn't a big deal and it didn't affect someone's ability to fly. On the other hand, we have this other term called spatial disorientation, and break-off is kind of one symptom in a constellation of weird things that can happen to you when you're flying, and it does cause pilot error, and quite a few people have died because of it.
Now, does it seem like there's a pattern of maybe who experiences break-off?
Well, the very early researchers made a few connections, and they're a little bit hazy. But if you had a history of mental illness, if you were just having a rough time on Earth, basically, you were more likely to experience the negative effects of breakoff. And one researcher I spoke to who was working on an Air Force base in the 80s and 90s worked with pilots very closely who didn't really want to tell her about breakoff and didn't want to tell her about their feelings at first. But when they opened up, they told her that some of the traumas and stresses they experienced on Earth would become magnified in flight. For example, a pilot who recently lost his son and his wife was flying, and he heard their voices. When he heard their voices, he realized that he was spiraling into a dive. He had made a very dangerous mistake, and he was able to pull himself out of it, but this is something that rattled him. And, you know, I think a lot of people have different experiences based on, I don't know, just their personalities, their experiences, the things that occupy their minds.
I'm speaking with Fast Company's Sydney Brownstone about the influence of space travel on mental health, specifically a phenomenon referred to as the breakoff effect. Now, you mentioned in your article that this phenomenon seems to have disappeared from the literature anyway in the 70s. Was it so hard to pin down? Partially, you mentioned that pilots are skeptical to talk to psychiatrists. Is that part of the issue?
It's hard to pin down. There's definitely something called the lie to fly culture, which is the idea that if you're a pilot or you're an astronaut, you don't want to say anything to your flight surgeon that's going to ground you and ruin your career. If you say, well, I was flying at 70,000 feet in a U-2 spy plane and I thought I heard the voice of my dead son, you know, the flight surgeon might think that you're not able to do your job. If you go into space because of G-forces or because of the ergonomics of the ship or, you know, just how our bodies are built, astronauts will puke. This is something that space tourists will almost certainly experience, too. A lot of space tourists will throw up for certain. But astronauts didn't want to show this to their flight surgeons for a very long time, so they tried to hide the fact that they were throwing up in space. So the fact that this disappeared in the 70s could be in part due to lie-to-fly culture. You know, as the space shuttle program was ramping up, NASA didn't want to cast the idea of an astronaut as someone who was vulnerable.
Well, I suppose the difference for space tourism is that you might be paying $250,000 to throw up in space. But astronauts, you know, they do go through these rigorous physical and mental tests to be able to determine whether or not they're fit for space travel. What about civilians who may pay in the future to go on these suborbital flights? Are they going to be tested in the same ways?
It's hard to tell because there's nothing really regulating this type of activity at the moment. But I did get the opportunity to visit a space training center called NASTAR, which has trained the first Virgin Galactic and X-Corps space tourists. And what they offer is a two-day training program to acclimate a person to G-forces. These are the acceleration forces that a person will feel both vertically and horizontally as they're going to space. So no, they are not subject to the same type of rigorous, you know, psychological, physical testing as astronauts were. And it's a completely different culture, too, because now, or presumably in the next couple of years, anyone who can afford space travel can go up. A lot of the selling points for these companies are, you know, you don't need to have a specialized background. We'll take you. We're making that available to you.
Well, does that seem okay to you, given that these are people that aren't going to be behind the controls? So maybe they can experience the breakoff phenomenon, but it won't be devastating because there's no chance that they'll spiral downwards and crash the plane.
Given the reporting that I've done, I do have concerns about this attitude being kind of cavalier and not communicating the fullness of the experience to these space tourists. Because if you're selling the overview effect, you're selling one kind of experience. It's going to be positive. It's going to be an epiphany. You're going to realize all these things about the Earth and your duty to protect it. It's got kind of this manifest destiny environmentalist slant to it, which you would think is positive, but without communicating the fact that you might go up there and your traumas or stresses might be magnified. I think it's important to say that there's a range of experiences a person could have, and we should be open to that.
Well, Sydney, thank you so much for taking time to explain this to us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Taylor.
Sydney Brownstone is staff writer for the Seattle newspaper The Stranger. She's also a contributor to Fast Company, where she wrote about the often ignored mental side of space travel. You will find a link to her article at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. In 2014, the Oklahoma-based craft chain Hobby Lobby won a Supreme Court case which allowed closely held corporations to refuse to cover contraception under employee health care benefits if it violated the owner of the company's religious beliefs. The family which owns Hobby Lobby is now hard at work on another complex Washington project, opening a museum of the Bible just blocks from the National Mall. The museum will make the Green family's vast and relatively new collection of biblical artifacts open to the public for the very first time, which also opens up questions about the origins of these very artifacts. Joel Baden and Candida Moss wrote about the museum in progress for The Atlantic. They spoke with Virginia Prescott.
Candida Moss, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Joel Baden, how are you? Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Well, the museum is slated for 2017. Now, this is just two blocks from the National Mall. First, a little on the scope. How big a museum? How expensive a project?
The museum itself is really quite enormous. 8 floors, anywhere between $500 million and $1 billion, depending on how you count, with between the cost of construction and purchase and the insurance and all of that. It's a really spectacularly large undertaking.
And who's paying for it?
It's mostly being paid for by the Green family, the owners of Hobby Lobby. They're the ones who had the vision 6 years ago to build the museum, and they're the ones who are putting up the vast majority of the money at this point.
And 6 years ago was pretty much when they started this collection, which is now really extensive, of biblical and related antiquities. So give us an idea of the scope. How big, what kind of artifacts does it contain?
Well, it is a very large private collection, certainly the largest biblical antiquities privately held in the world. It has about 40,000 artifacts, which is an incredibly fast accumulation of artifacts when you think about it. And it includes everything from cuneiform tablets to modern Bibles held by celebrities to papyri, small fragments of the earliest copies of the Bible.
So is it normal for these sorts of collections to be accumulated so quickly?
This is highly unusual. We have seen collectors, especially wealthy collectors before, build a collection, but this usually takes place over decades and with a great deal of care. And one of the questions that people have about this collection is, when you are buying artifacts so rapidly, do you really have the time to figure out where have those artifacts come from? What is it that you're buying? And is everything that you have authentic?
Well, this is a big question, especially now, as with all art museums. You know, the provenance is very important. It comes especially after more than a decade of war in the Middle East. What has the ongoing conflict there meant for the antiquities trade?
Well, I would say that it's not even just the last 10 years. It's really the last 30. Any kind of political instability creates a situation in which looting occurs. And looters can, in fact, be very savvy. They know that antiquities are worth a lot to foreign buyers. And so in situations of military and political turmoil, museums and private collections will be looted, archaeological sites will be looted, and the artifacts that are discovered there, be they statues or coins or papyri, will be sold on the black market and can eventually wind up in prominent museums, in private collections, and so on. And the issue is, when you purchase something that you don't know where it's come from, that might have been looted, you are, in fact, feeding this world. You're feeding the black market and contributing to a market in which people are killed and terrorism is funded.
So are there any kind of laws that govern private sales and collections for people who are buying them to make sure and guarantee the provenance?
Yes, there are. The UNESCO Convention decreed that anything that did not have a clear provenance that was purchased after 1970 could not be imported. And that convention by UNESCO, it became law when it was ratified by various countries, which happened over the next two decades. But what this means now is if you're importing something into the United States and you cannot prove that it was in a collection of some kind before 1970, it is effectively illegal.
Joel Biden, has the Green family in particular come under specific scrutiny for anything that they've purchased?
Well, they have, actually. We reported last month in the Daily Beast that for the last 4 years or so, actually, the federal government has been investigating the Green family for a shipment of cuneiform tablets, so 3,000-year-old, out of what's now Iraq, clay tablets. Probably not of the most exciting content, but the Greens are collecting these sorts of things. They're highly collectible. There's a lot of them out there. And they seem to have purchased these in some sort of shady manner. The federal government got involved when it was discovered that these were being imported by Hobby Lobby and were being sort of misdescribed on their importation documents. Instead of being described as 3,000-year-old valuable clay tablets, they were described as tile samples and valued at a few hundred dollars for a few hundred tablets. They did at least something, it seems to us, that warranted federal scrutiny. The question is, how much like that is there? And really, it's a matter of whether they've done their due diligence with the vast majority of their other items. We don't think everything they bought came in this sort of illegally imported way, but we do have lots of questions about how far they went to make sure that everything they bought was correctly provenanced.
Well, and of course, the sales and destruction of antiquities has been big news, especially since ISIS has been gaining a foothold in certain parts of the Middle East, certainly Syria and Iraq. Is there a clear connection between those sales and supporting a group like ISIS?
So part of the issue is the market for antiquities is on about a five-year cycle. So anything that comes out of the ground, anything that's looted or stolen from a museum today will not make its way onto the market for sale for about 5 years. So anything that's out there now that people are aware of is probably not directly ISIS related. That is, it's probably got to do with looting that goes back to Taliban or other groups before that, Al-Qaeda, going all the way back to the Gulf War in 91 when most of this really took off. So it's too much to say, as some people have, that Hobby Lobby or anybody purchasing antiquities is directly funding ISIS. What we do really think is important to recognize is that the purchase of unprovenanced antiquities, as Candida said, supports the market for antiquities. And if there's a strong market, that's incentive for ISIS to loot, because ISIS loots antiquities and then sells them. So there's two different, there's a public face and a private face, and there's a time delay that means that it's not directly supporting ISIS yet, but in a few years, people who are purchasing antiquities will be purchasing ISIS-looted stuff.
We're talking with Joel Biden and Candida Moss. They're both biblical scholars, about plans for a new museum of the Bible just blocks from the National Mall. And it's funded by the family that owns the Hobby Lobby craft chain. Of course, the building of a museum in itself is interesting to us, but especially from this family, who a lot of people have followed since that case in 2014, the religious freedom case that went to the Supreme Court. The Green family has shown themselves, in other words, to be sort of crusaders for evangelical principles, yet they've described the museum and its mission as non-sectarian. What do you think would be the draw for non-believers?
I think for non-believers visiting the museum, it's interesting to see ancient artifacts. It's interesting to see artifacts from the past and the history of the Bible, which is truly the world's most important book. I think we still have to ask the question, is it a non-sectarian museum? And it seems clear when you look at interviews with the Greens and people involved in the Museum of the Bible that they want people, non-believers, who visit the museum to come out as believers. They do think that the power of Scripture will be to transform those people if they come into contact with it. And while they say that the museum is non-sectarian now, when they initially submitted their tax filings, they actually had a much more evangelical mission. And it's worth noting that there are no plans to include, say, Islam, which is part of the history of the Bible, or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that's Mormonism, which is too part of the history of the Bible in the museum. So it may not be a Baptist museum, but I don't think that we could say that it's truly non-sectarian.
A lot of resources here for biblical scholars now held in one family collection and made accessible to scholars through the museum. But what is it about the nature of the research? What are they trying to do? Come up with a definitive biblical text or original biblical text?
You know, for a lot of particularly evangelical Christians, you know, there's a great desire to get as close as possible to the original words of the Bible, which, you know, for them, it also means, right, the very words that Jesus spoke. And recognizing that there's, you know, 2,000 years of copying and recopying of text, for them, the idea is that the earliest texts we can find is the closest to actually, you know, the original and the words of Jesus and, you know, the word of the Lord as directly on the page. So, you know, as they are collecting these things and giving them to scholars to study, they have an interest in finding the earliest versions and affirming that the text of the Bible that they believe in is the original text of the Bible, going all the way back to the time of Jesus. So they have there is a religious ideology behind a particular kind of scholarship that is searching for the earliest, the best, the closest, the most original.
Yeah, so what happens if something shows up that doesn't follow their narrative? I mean, we've seen such fragments surface, Gnostic Gospels, Gospel of Judas, and the like. What happens then?
Well, it is certainly Museum of the Bible, not Museum of the Apocrypha. So it's not clear that any of those kinds of apocryphal texts like the Gospel of Jesus' wife or the Gospel of Judas or the Gospel of Thomas will be making it into the museum. But there's one story we were told by the former director in which David Green, the current head of the Green family, told him that he would not use this collection to undermine the King James version of the Bible because they had some manuscripts that could be seen as supporting that. So it does seem that the Greens are very unwilling to produce a museum or exhibit or research that would undermine their vision of Christianity.
Is it likely that the Bible Museum's location, its funding, its size is going to make it the de facto, let's say, national authority on all things biblical?
Well, there's really no competition, to be fair. It's not like there are art museums all over the world and all over the country, but there aren't that many Bible museums elsewhere. There's one or two. They're small. They're usually you know, specifically fundamentalist, the Creation Museum in Louisville, for example, right? They're all going to be, those sorts of things are going to be sectarian. The Museum of the Bible that the Greens are building obviously intends to be the national museum of the Bible, as it were. It is going to be much bigger. This is a very public, very important, and very well-publicized project. There is going to be no other museum that is anywhere close to it. And because of its location just off of the mall, people are going to visit it, not even perhaps most of the time knowing that they're not going to, say, the Smithsonian Museum of the Bible. It's that close. And it's positioned not only in sort of the museum alleyway, but also very, very close to the Capitol. And its location may be sort of a matter of what was the best space we could get at the time, but now you get the sense very clearly that the Greens are sort of turning their attention slightly towards the Capitol and seeing what kind of influence they can exert in that direction from their museum.
Joel Baden, thank you for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And Candida Moss, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Joel Baden is a professor of Hebrew Bible at Yale Divinity School. Candida Moss is a professor of the New Testament at the University of Notre Dame. They are co-authors of Reconceiving Infertility, Biblical Perspectives on Procreation and Childlessness, and wrote about the Green Family's Bible Museum set to open in Washington, D.C. in 2017 for The Atlantic. Thanks for listening today. Check out more from the show at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget, you can also listen to the show on demand by subscribing to our podcast. You can find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or wherever you listen. It's just what you hear on the radio, only you can take us wherever you go. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan, and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.